From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how's Michigan doing as it prepares for the Affordable Health Care Act?
If we don't participate and the deadline is tomorrow, then we give up about $9 million in federal planning grants.
Plus, it's been 15 long months since a Flint man went to Iran to visit his grandmother and was arrested as a spy.
Does he wish he never went? Absolutely. My grandmother even says, I wish if I was not here in Iran that he didn't have a reason to come there and see me.
We talk with the sister of imprisoned former Marine Amir Hekmati. And Chrysler doubles down on jobs in Southeast Michigan.
When they're adding these 1,000 jobs to a truck assembly plant, they're saying we don't see a recession coming.
Plus, a local hero receives the French Legion of Honor. Those stories and more on Stateside, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Ever since the election, you can scarcely open a newspaper or turn on a newscast without hearing about health insurance exchanges. They're a key part of the Federal Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. And now that the next president of the United States will not be Mitt Romney, who had vowed to dismantle Obamacare, it's time to sort out exactly what's coming and what it means for you. We'll talk about the politics behind creating the health insurance exchanges in a moment. But first, let's start by getting a basic understanding of what a health insurance exchange really is. For that, we turn to Helen Levy. She's with the University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we know that the health insurance exchange is a crucial part of the Affordable Care Act, but I think people are still confused. Just what is a health insurance exchange?
A health insurance exchange is a marketplace, and it's designed to bring together people who want to buy insurance and insurance companies that want to sell it to them.
So we think of it, as you say, like a marketplace. That name exchange, I think, tripped me up when I first heard about it. It's like exchanging what? But it's exchange in the sense of here I am, I'm looking for insurance, and you have it.
That's right. And it may be easier to think of it as a connector, which is actually the name that Massachusetts, which has had an exchange since 2006, that's the name that they use.
So how will it be set up? If once this is happening, and I need insurance and I go to a health exchange site, what will it look like?
Well, it's going to look something like Travelocity, but for health insurance, or it's going to look like healthinsurance.com. So you can go, you can scroll through the policies, you see what the different benefits are and the premiums, and then you can pick one.
And how will having access to this exchange make a difference for people in Michigan?
Well, the exchanges are intended to provide not just a place to buy coverage, but they're a part of this larger plan that includes guaranteed issue, meaning the insurance companies have to sell you a policy, and also community rating, meaning they have to charge everybody the same thing. So it's not so much just that it's a shopping portal, as it's a key part of making affordable insurance available to everyone.
All right. And we certainly know that that's the whole key part of the Affordable Care Act. So will it spell out specific types of coverage that would have to be offered? So if I'm shopping, I can really pull in those details? Or does it send me on my way and then I start making calls from there?
No. The benefits are more or less specified in the federal law, what has to be covered in terms of which types of services. And then there are different levels of plans. So you can buy a bronze, silver, gold, or platinum plan. And those different metals refer to the generosity of the financial terms of coverage. And of course, the premiums are going to vary depending on how generous a plan you choose for yourself.
Helen, in your opinion, once the exchange is up and running in Michigan, how well do you think it'll achieve its goal of helping uninsured people find health insurance?
Well, the best example we have is in Massachusetts, where it's been tremendously successful. So Massachusetts only has 4% of its population uninsured now. It's the lowest rate in the nation, and it's been a big success there.
Helen, thanks for talking with us on Stateside.
It's been a pleasure.
Helen Levy is with the University of Michigan. Now, the issue politically of these exchanges has been kicked around like a soccer ball among Governor Snyder, Attorney General Bill Schuette, State Senate Republicans, and State House Republicans. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, joins us. Rick, let's start with the fact that the health insurance exchange could be set up by the state or it could be set up by Uncle Sam. What has Governor Snyder wanted?
Well, what Governor Snyder wanted, and a lot of business people did as well, was if there's going to be an exchange, for it to be a Michigan-run exchange. They say that that would give Michigan a lot more control over its own fate when it comes to dealing with these federal health care reforms and how individuals and businesses would shop online for their health care coverage. He and these business groups did not get what they want because State House Republicans said first they were going to wait for the U.S. Supreme Court to rule, and the Supreme Court ruled. And then at the urging of Attorney General Bill Schuette, who was also Mitt Romney's Michigan campaign chair, said, well, you know, wait for the results of the election. And if, you know, we couldn't conceivably see some repeal of a lot of the elements of Obamacare. And of course, the president was reelected. The U.S. Senate remains under Democratic control. So that's not really going to change. And so that brings us to this particular juncture.
All right. So there is no Mitt Romney, President Romney, to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. So what is coming up next now for us in Michigan?
Well, two things that House Republicans say that they still have not made a decision on what they want to do about the federal health care reforms, and especially the Michigan exchange, and also whether Michigan will participate in an expansion of the Medicaid program. On the exchange, what that means is that if we don't participate and the deadline is tomorrow, then we give up about $9 million in federal planning grants. That means that whatever we put together, we've got to foot the bill ourselves. So there's that. Now, Governor Snyder, and, you know, he's an old tech industry guy, they say Michigan already needed to be well along the path on this, that creating this online exchange, it's big, it's technical, you really can't buy anything off the shelf to do it. Some people are disputing that. And so, you know, you've got to set up the system, you've got to test the system, you've got to find the vendors, you've got to negotiate the contracts, you've got to sign the contracts, and getting all of that done, ready, and reliable by October 1st just doesn't seem to be in the cards at this point. So it's possible that anything that the legislature, that the House Republicans did now anyway, would be with an eye towards some point in the future, maybe October 1st of 2014, for Michigan to take over its own exchange. At the same time, you know, Republicans are also facing some pressure from their Tea Party factions that are saying, we don't think that these federal health care reforms can work, and that if states don't cooperate, then the system will just collapse.
And what would that mean for people in Michigan who would want to use the exchange? States like Colorado were able to move ahead with their state-run exchange because they got cooperation. Will the people there fare better than people in Michigan?
Well, that remains to be seen. You know, 15 states, they're going to do the exchange. I think 14 or 15 states have said absolutely not. Michigan is one of four states that's looking at a sort of a hybrid, a partnership option with the federal government that won't require legislative approval. As a matter of fact, Governor Snyder is in Las Vegas right now at a meeting of the Republican Governors Association, and I'm told that he's actually quizzing, you know, other governors on what they intend to do about this. I mean, of course, because it's so new, we don't know for sure. But I was talking to someone with a business group that's opposed this, who said that you know, what his organization is looking at is either taking a political position of non-cooperation that might cost them more in the short run because they've got to deal with a federal bureaucracy rather than a state one, you know, versus a practical one that would probably save them, you know, would save them money on coverage if they're willing to accept something that they didn't like before.
Bottom line, Rick, do you think that people in Michigan will be helped or hurt by the State House Republicans digging in this way?
Well, you're asking me a question above my pay level. What I can say is for the people who've looked at this, that you look at the business groups, including, you know, the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce, the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, that have said, regardless of what we think about Obamacare, we would rather this being run by Michigan so that if we've got an issue that we can go to Michigan administrators, we can go to our legislature and say, do something about it, rather than try to work through Washington. They say a Michigan-based exchange is a better deal, that the people who are opposed to the exchange at this point seem to be the ones who are saying, we expect it to fail, and we'd like to help hasten that end. And at the fulcrum of this, you have the House Republicans who are saying, we've still got some questions that need to be answered. And some of them are questions that you're asking. What exactly is the difference between a state exchange and a federal exchange? And apparently, after months and months of hearings and waiting on these other, these other questions to be answered, that they still haven't figured that out yet.
And one might just argue, looking at the Tea Party folks saying, we're digging in, we don't want to participate. House Republicans are still kind of not on board. Has the train not left the station as of Election Day last week? Did we not get a pretty clear sense that, hey, this is happening, like it or not?
And people who say that the election was a referendum on things like, you know, what we should do to balance the federal budget vis-a-vis allowing tax breaks for wealthier Americans to expire, things like whether or not we should have a federal health care law. If you believe that the election was a referendum on that, along with the reelection of the president, then you're saying, you know, guys, you need to accept the reality of their situation. And there are just still some groups out there that still have a voice that are saying, you know, we were not cooperating before. We are not cooperating now.
Michigan Public Radio Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. Thanks, Rick.
My pleasure, Cindy.
Meanwhile, just today, the chairman of the Republican Governors Association, Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, sent a letter on behalf of other GOP governors to President Obama. The letter requests more time and federal guidance for states to create the exchanges. Open enrollment for exchange plans is supposed to start October 1st, 2013, and health insurance coverage should begin January 1st, 2014. Still to come, just how totally awesome is the Midwest? Well, we'll ask the author of The Midwest, God's Gift to Planet Earth. That's in 5 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some big, big headlines coming down today from Chrysler. After the automaker's brush with extinction just a few short years ago, threatening tens of thousands of jobs, it's always encouraging to hear jobs are coming back. Tracy Samilton covers the auto industry for Michigan Radio News. Hi, Tracy.
Hi.
So, good news today from Chrysler?
Yeah, it's definitely good news. They're adding maybe 250 jobs to their Mack engine plant right in Detroit. In Warren, they're going to be adding a third shift at their truck assembly plant. So, 1,000 new workers coming into that plant on the third shift. Very good news.
Quite significant. And this isn't recycling. This is new hires, new jobs.
These are new hires. Now, these folks are almost all going to be these tier two entry level folks who are getting, you know, the $14 to $16 an hour wage. But these are, you know, these are still very good jobs. They have excellent benefits. And, you know, they may be working side by side with someone who's making $28 an hour. But, you know, this unemployment is still very high in the region, and you just cannot say that this is not good news.
And what does this say overall about Chrysler's health and what it's selling?
One thing I think it says is they are betting that the U.S. economy is indeed picking up. The housing sector is looking good. So when they're adding these 1,000 jobs to a truck assembly plant, they're saying we don't see a recession coming. We think we're going to keep this sort of slow recovery going on because it's a major investment to add that number of people and the kind of investment they're putting in the plant. So Chrysler at least thinks pickup truck sales are going to increase, and that is why they're putting these people here. So, I think it's a very good sign, not just for our region, but for the economy as a whole.
Tracy, thanks for talking with us today.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
3-4 Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Has this ever happened to you? You're at a party, let's say in New York, and someone says, "So, where are you from?" And you answer, "Michigan," or any one of the Midwest states. What happens? Well, they may look at you as if you wandered in from another planet, the planet Midwest. They might even wonder aloud if you have plumbing. That actually happened to writer Mike Draper, who is from Iowa, and he got so tired of realizing that to many Americans, the Midwest might as well be a foreign country. So he planted his tongue fairly firmly in his cheek and turned out a book called The Midwest, God's Gift to Planet Earth, an illustrated guide to the history and culture of the galaxy's most important region. Mike, not too modestly titled, may I note?
It's a fair and balanced look at our region.
I want to open with your thoughts. It's one of my favorite quotes from your book, and here is your thought. The Midwest is a mystery wrapped in a riddle and then deep fat fried at the Iowa State Fair and served on a stick. Why do you think we're such a mystery to the rest of the nation?
I think part of it is that nobody really knows where it is. And then the other part is that nobody really cares what goes on here. So it's kind of a mystery, not that we aim to be a mystery, but a mystery because most people aren't all that curious about what is here.
Well, that term flyover country is so dismissive and arrogant, and I've always hated that, but that's the way they look at us, isn't it?
Yeah, which is funny because we invented the plane, so it'd be hard to fly over us without us.
So there. All right, so looking back through American history, in your opinion, who do you think are some of the most influential Midwesterners? Besides, like you said, we invented the plane, so there.
Yeah, I mean, you could take the Wright brothers. I mean, you could go to Henry Ford, you know, if you wanted to stay in Michigan, but even, you know, beyond the Wright brothers, a guy like Stout, you know, the first commercial airline service was between Detroit and Grand Rapids. And so I think through time, the funny thing that I noticed was how easy the book was to write. You know, people will ask what the single most impressive thing about the Midwest that I learned was. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was just the volume of people that we have produced and how some of America's greatest people are Midwesterners, whether it's landing on the moon with Neil Armstrong, winning the Second World War with Eisenhower and Bradley, the First World War with Pershing, humor from Mark Twain all the way to Johnny Carson. Almost every facet of American life, there is a prominent Midwesterner involved.
What do you find as you talk with people from other parts of the country? What are some of the most common misconceptions floating around out there about the Midwest?
I think that the toughest thing for us is that the Midwest is viewed as, you know, the American Gothic pastoral farmland, which as a region, it's really a minority of it. I mean, for me, I grew up in Iowa outside Des Moines, but my parents aren't farmers. I actually had no idea how farming worked because most of the state isn't in agriculture. My dad's an attorney. My mom's actually a mechanical engineer from Michigan. And so that's what I think is hard for people to get, is that they envision the whole area as rural and agricultural. And that's one thing it's hard for the Midwest to view itself as a cohesive region, because even, you know, the Midwest views the Midwest as rural and agricultural.
Yeah, like so it's corn and cows.
Yeah, and it's hard to really get the breadth of, you know, geography from Ohio to the Dakotas, and also the breadth of economy, that it's the Midwest has never been primarily an agricultural economy. There's always been agriculture, but it has produced, you know, industry from the steel plow to then to the car to the airplane. Some of America's biggest cities and industrial might is in the Midwest.
Yeah, there's this place called Chicago, you know?
Yeah, you know? I've heard of it.
Yeah, you make the argument in your book, The Midwest, God's Gift to Planet Earth, that if the Midwest was its own country, it would be a superpower?
Yeah, if you just took the Midwest and looked at the population and the GDP and took the America out of it, we'd be the fourth largest economy just behind Germany. And in terms of GDP per person of the biggest economies, we'd be just right behind Japan. So we only have 67 million people, but a $3 trillion economy. And that's another thing that people kind of put by the wayside, is there's this arc of the Midwest through history where, you know, the 1800s through about 1950, it was just, you know, hit after hit for us, from the first two Super Bowls to the car to the airplane. And then there's this view of Midwestern history that it's just been a downhill slide since then, of like, you know, Rust Belt and industrial agriculture, and that we're just waiting for, you know, somebody to extinguish the tire fire on their way out.
Like, trust me, we're familiar with those kinds of stories in Detroit.
And it's interesting to, when you look at just the Fortune 500 in America, the Midwest has, you know, as many companies in the top 10 as the South. And so the South and the Midwest are the tide for the most companies. And that companies like General Motors and Ford are not small, dead companies. They're bigger than every commercial bank in America. They're bigger than Apple. They're bigger than Google. And so these are the kind of things that we tried to point out of how much Midwest has done, but also how much it has currently.
And that's why you say reports of our economic demise have been greatly exaggerated.
Yeah.
You also note that our Midwest superpower would be conservative and liberal.
Yeah, it's the other fascinating thing about the Midwest is that it's easy to pin, you know, the South as Republican and religiously conservative, because it has often voted entirely Republican. And it's easy to pin the Northeast as, you know, liberal and kind of voting Democrat, because it has several times voted entirely Democratic. The Midwest has only voted entirely for one party in, I think, two elections.
Hmm.
There are so many bizarre examples, from Iowa legalizing gay marriage just 4 hours away from the Westboro Baptist Church, who are just like nuts. You know, Minnesota putting an amendment to ban gay marriage, trying to pass it this year in their constitution, but Minneapolis being labeled the gayest city in America by like a gay magazine. So that's what this strange dichotomy in the Midwest of conservative to liberal, you know, back in history of, you know, Wisconsin had some of the most progressive politicians with guys like La Follette. But then nowadays, Kansas and the Dakotas have some of the most conservative people in charge. And it was even a note this year that you had a guy from Chicago running against a guy from Michigan who picked a conservative guy from Wisconsin as his running mate.
Good point.
The Midwest is always going to produce multiple types of people, which makes us kind of hard to pin down.
Speaking of pinning down, you spend a lot of time in your book, Mike, talking about Midwest, typical Midwest stars in movies, TV, and music. Give us some of your favorite examples of Midwest stars.
Well, the thing we like is that the fictional character of the Midwest is what always attracted me first. If you look at these mysterious figures, it's interesting to note that so many of them are from the Midwest. You know, Superman is from Kansas, Magnum P.I. is from Detroit, Jason Bourne is from Missouri, down to Jay Gatsby from North Dakota, Don Draper from Mad Men is from Illinois, even Edward Cullen from Twilight is from Chicago.
Yeah.
And it pops up all the time, and I think part of that is a lot of the creative people from, you know, Hemingway to Fitzgerald were from the Midwest. But also, if you're looking to have just a character that is built-in mystery that could be anything, you, like, pluck him from Nebraska, because nobody knows what goes on there. He could be the son of steel mill workers. He could be a farmer. He could be a psychopath.
Because that's such a blank slate.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who just hears Nebraska. But it's funny that, you know, we look at it as there's the two sides of us, of the Superman side and the clinging to guns and religion side, of people view Midwesterners as simple, which on the Superman side makes us, you know, genuine, trustworthy, hardworking. And on the guns and religion side makes us like dumb as bricks, that we don't trust anybody with a passport, and we vote for Ronald Reagan whether he's running or not, from dog catcher to president.
You do know trustworthiness is a hallmark of the Midwest. Does that stem back to Honest Abe?
Yeah, I mean, he kind of emboldened the trustworthiness, and you don't know where it comes from. I mean, there is the mix of agriculture, of dependency on the land, a dependency on other people. I think a lot stems from the weather. When I grew up in Iowa, people said, oh, the weather's here like nowhere else in the world. And then I moved to Philadelphia, and they said, the weather here is like nowhere else in the world.
And we say that in Michigan.
And then I moved to Scotland. They said, the weather here is like nowhere else in the world.
Yeah.
But the Midwest really is, its weather is almost unique from anywhere in the world. We have more in common with Japan than we do with the South, which is you have some of the most extreme temperatures for a livable region and precipitation year-round. And I think having, you know, long winters, but then also extremely hot summers is kind of good for people to, you know, it keeps you humble.
Well, it just, I can remember my first ever visit to California, and I was there in October, and it just seemed wrong not to have crunchy leaves and golden light, and everything was white, light, and hot.
Yeah.
It just seemed a little wrong.
Well, and it's funny to think of, you know, we point out in the book that, you know, Michigan, I think it used to be on the license plates, said a winter wonderland.
Yes.
And so there used to be this joke when I would go up there that people would say, well, it's a winter wonderland. What do you do in the summer? And they'd say, well, if it falls on a Sunday, we have a picnic. And a lot of people view the Midwest as a really cold climate, that it's all blizzards and then, you know, hot for 1 month, which really isn't true. The heat is oftentimes worse than the cold.
Yes.
And so you get both sides of it. And, you know, in 1936, North Dakota set the record for largest temperature swing when it hit 120 degrees in the summer and minus 60 in the winter all in 1 year.
Toughens you up, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it does something. Or it makes you move to California.
Mike, in your book, The Midwest, God's Gift to Planet Earth, you talk about typical Midwestern food. Talk about that because, hey, the Midwest gave the world fried butter on a stick, didn't we?
Yeah, we've given the it lots of things. We kind of point out, you know, we tried to do the book in a realistic sense. And so we talked about things like movies like Food, Inc. and Industrial Agriculture and Type 2 Diabetes and Corn Syrup. And we framed that as one of the ways we're getting back at the rest of the country for mistreating us, is that, you know, they've given us insults about our region, so we've given them Type 2 Diabetes, which hasn't been the best strategy since the Midwest is the heaviest region after the South. So we're losing a couple of our own. But it's when you watch a movie like Food, Inc., you know, he says that all food comes back to a cornfield in Iowa, and that, you know, these companies are these evil corporations controlling everything we eat, and they're not on Wall Street. They're like Pioneer Hybrid in Iowa or Monsanto in St. Louis or DeKalb in Illinois. So the Midwest is pulling the strings.
In your book, you make a pretty good argument for the fact that, in your, as you put it, the Midwest really, really, really hearts NPR.
Yeah, we even have a special page on where we talk about our love of NPR. And one of the problems, I mean, if you look at some of the biggest like NPR stars, a lot of them come out of the Midwest, especially like Garrison Keillor. And Garrison Keillor was a guy who tried to take his show to NPR, but then they turned him down. And so, you know, Garrison Keillor was the one who started his own Public Radio International and started distributing his show by himself. And it was interesting that, you know, the president of NPR at the time, who wasn't from the Midwest, his problem with Garrison Keillor's show was that it was too elitist, that it mocked small-town America in the Midwest, which is ironic because that's where Keillor was from.
Right.
He was from a small town in Minnesota. And so, and Keillor went on with Public Radio International to pick out some other stars like Ira Glass, whose show was also turned down at NPR.
Give us your take. You break down all the states in the Midwest, but we'd love to hear your view of Michigan, as you say, where the trees are just the right height.
Yeah, that was probably my favorite quote from the Romney campaign. I just thought, man, this guy must be strange when it comes to complimenting his wife. Like, you know what I like about your toenails? And it was interesting because he said, you know, I love the big lakes and the little lakes, too. And you're like, you don't want to lose the little lake vote.
You want that little lake vote and that tree vote.
Yeah, and it was interesting for me because I was born in Des Moines, but my mom grew up in East Grand Rapids. So she was the oldest of seven. She and her four brothers all went to the University of Michigan for engineering. And so they have a record for the most mechanical engineers from one family at the University of Michigan. And so I knew the University of Michigan fight song by the time I was five. The only Iowa football game we ever watched was when they played Michigan. And I used to spend all my summers up in Leelanau County with my maternal grandparents, have a house in Lake Leelanau. You know, northern Michigan, I haven't spent a lot of time in the UP, but just, you know, right around Traverse City is one of the most, you know, beautiful places in the entire world. I've lived in Scotland, London, New York. I lived in Switzerland and Germany for a while. But, I mean, everything there is perfect. You have huge bodies of fresh water. Having grown up there and sailed and swam in Lake Michigan, the first time I went to the ocean and swam in it when I was 12, I just thought, like, who would do this? You have to take a shower after you get out. I mean, you can drink Lake Michigan. And so it's such an amazing part of the world. And I think Michigan actually is one of those states that has, you know, kind of the most potential in that the reason why the Midwest was hit a little bit harder than other regions is that we were the most industrialized. And it's not that we're moving from industrial to non-industrial, it's that we're moving from industrial to industrial that requires fewer people. You know, Gary, Indiana makes as much steel as it ever has, but it employs 10% of the workers. So on the one hand, you know, there's an issue to be addressed, but on the other hand, it's not a simple story of the steel industry has died. And same with the car industry. But, you know, Detroit is a city that can also lead in terms of how do you retrofit a city that was made for heavy industry, you know, so it can be at the forefront of what a modern city looks like. And for all the talk of, you know, China really only climbs the ladder that America built. You know, they're still just making things for us. You know, Detroit was an innovative city and now still kind of has to be innovative in terms of determining what future cities look like. So I always view it as a state with, like, a lot of potential, but also you have tons of lakes, so you have several legs up on Iowa there.
There you go. You know, I have to say, Mike Draper, for a guy that is a T-shirt guy, you're quite a researcher and quite a writer.
Thanks. My first job was writing for an alternative weekly in Des Moines in high school, and then I studied history at the University of Pennsylvania. So I was supposed to be getting a PhD in history, but my writing style kind of clashed with academia. And
think?
So this is my way of circumventing the whole system.
Mike Draper is the author of The Midwest, God's Gift to Planet Earth. It's published by Ray Gunn. You can find it at RayGunnSite.com. It's been a lot of fun talking with you, Mike. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Still to come, we'll speak with the sister of the Michigan man being detained in Iran. And in 15 minutes, we spotlight a local hero. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been an agonizing 15 months for one Flint family ever since August 2011. That's when Amir Hekmati, Flint Central High School class of 2001, was arrested while visiting his grandmother and relatives in Iran. He was accused of being a spy and sentenced to death by an Iranian court in January of this year. But 2 months later, Iran's Supreme Court found the verdict against Hekmati was not complete. It overturned the death sentence and ordered a retrial. He is still sitting in an Iranian prison awaiting that new trial. His family and friends in Flint are doing everything possible to keep Amir Hekmati's name in the headlines and keep his plight before the eyes of the world. Part of that effort is an art show opening this Saturday in Detroit. It's called Jailed Humanity, in support of an American's quest for freedom from an Iranian prison. Amir's sister, Sarah Hekmati, joins us now. Sarah, how did you come on the idea of an art exhibit to help highlight your brother's plight?
Well, it wasn't my idea. It was something that was I was approached by a friend, Manal Qadri. She's an artist in the Detroit area, and she thought that by using art, we could tell Amir's story of detention and use themes surrounding human rights, peace, hope. Everything in the exhibit is going to be directly reflecting Amir or inspired by his situation.
So give us an idea of the kinds of works we'll be seeing.
Well, we were very fortunate. There was a lot of generous artists that graciously donated their art from across the country. So we have local artists. We have artists from all over the U.S. And the exhibit will have drawings, paintings, photography, political cartoons, some three-dimensional art. So a lot of that is there's going to be a good variety. And the great thing about the venue is that it was a former Detroit precinct. The gallery itself still has the remains of, you know, jail cells, and it really kind of it's a great venue that gives more of a realistic idea of his detention.
Sarah, it must mean a lot to your family to have people that you've never met stepping forward to offer support.
Oh, it's so humbling, but it sends such a strong message about the power of humanity and how when people are in crisis, even if you don't know your neighbor or someone that's going through something next to you, that you'll still reach a hand and try to be helpful. And I think that it's been very inspiring. The situation, as difficult as it's been, has allowed us to cross paths with some really beautiful people that have helped us to stay strong, because As you know, this is going on over a year of unknowns and no contact with Amir, no idea how he's doing and what his conditions are. And then on top of that, in September, finding out that our father has brain cancer and how are we going to manage with his treatment. And on top of that, trying to get developments with Amir's case in Iran and not really knowing anything about what's going on. So we're really trying our best to stay afloat, and I think people in the community being there for us has made it happen.
Sarah, your family drew national and international headlines during the U.S. visit this fall of Iran's President Ahmadinejad, begging for your brother's release because of your father's brain cancer. Did anything at all come from those efforts?
Well, we were fortunate. We had made attempts prior to even knowing about my father's condition to make visits in New York and actually meet with the president, knowing that he was going to be coming. He comes once a year, and we wanted to take up this opportunity. And then suddenly my father was rushed to the hospital, and we were faced with that. And, you know, it kind of worked in a way. And, you know, God works in funny ways, I guess, if you want to look at it. But by knowing that he was going to have this really grim prognosis and the president of Iran happened to be here at the same time, we thought we could really push a little harder and raise awareness. And it did get the attention of the president of Iran, and he was asked questions about Amir's case in ways that I don't think, because we were denied a visit to meet with him in private, we would have not had that opportunity.
You know, I have to wonder, when your brother went to visit grandma and relatives in Iran, was there any sense of concern of having him do that? Did you wish that he didn't go?
Oh, absolutely. I know my mom was very wary of his decision to go. She had the initial plan was for him to go with the family earlier in the summer, but with scheduling conflicts and things that came up, he wasn't able to. And so my mom had told him, well, you know, we'll try to go again next summer, and then you can come with us. And he had enrolled for classes at the University of Michigan, and so he thought, if he doesn't take up an opportunity for this window of time that opened up for him in August, that he might not get a chance. And my grandmother, being older, he hadn't seen her since he was 12 years old, so he felt like this would have been a great opportunity. He might not have this chance, you know, if, God forbid, something were to happen to her.
Sure.
So he really, he took that risk, but it's a risk that he thought was worth taking because he felt that he may not have a chance to see her again, and he may not get an opportunity with school and things that might come up in his career. So I know, looking back, does he wish he never went? Absolutely. My grandmother even says, I wish if I was not here in Iran that he didn't have a reason to come there and see me.
So was there really a sense that if he came by himself, he would be more of a
target, yeah,
as opposed to coming with the whole family?
Well, as a young man and on his own, and as an American and someone who had never been to the country before, it's not like he frequents going and coming. So I think he might, you know, we think that might be why he was more of a target.
So when did you hear that he had been arrested and charged as a spy? Did you get a phone call? Who called you? Was it your grandmother? How did you find out?
Well, he went August 14th, and then he was with family for 2 weeks, and then August 29th, he disappeared, and the family was frantic. They thought he might have been kidnapped. They had no idea where he was. And then when we were calling around to the Iranian interest section in Washington, D.C., and the United Nations Iran mission in New York, and trying to figure out what could have happened, we ended up finding out that he was able to give a phone call to a relative in Iran from prison to let them know that he was detained. And so the family would try to follow up for weeks to the prison that he had called from, and nobody was willing to admit that he was detained. So it was very confusing to us why he's getting a phone call to say he's in prison, but no one can verify that he's there. And so we really didn't know anything about his status until the end of October. So if you can imagine, from the end of August till the end of October, not really knowing where he is. And then on top of that, finding out where he is to confirm that he's there, but then he has no charge. So for 2 months, and the charge that we were given in December was really a surprise to us, because at that point, we were just told he's being investigated. some of the questions that came up were, you know, the suspicion of him being there because he was a former Marine, and, you know, why would someone that's a former Marine possibly working for the U.S. government doing visiting in Iran? And we were willing to explain all of that, but our voices were not being heard when it came to reaching out to the people that could make those decisions to release him.
Is there an attorney? Who's handling his defense?
He has an attorney there in Iran, and we also have an attorney for him here. And so we've been trying to connect and get insight into the developments of his case, but the attorney there is even limited to having access to him. In a whole year, he's seen Amir 3 times. And it's not because he hasn't tried, it's because he's not being given permission to see him.
Is the Red Cross able to intervene in any way?
The Red Cross has tried to send letters that we've written through the Red Crescent that's in Tehran, mm-hmm. and those have, to our knowledge, not been delivered.
What about within the U.S. government? Who's been the most receptive to helping your family?
Well, the State Department has always been involved since the very beginning. They've tried to send letters, send information, request consular access for him. And they work through the Swiss ambassador in Tehran because there is no U.S. embassy in Iran anymore since 1979, and so it's something that has to go through the Swiss. She often tries to request consular access to see him to be able to verify, you know, what his conditions are, how he's being treated, and they're always denying access to her.
Has your family ever thought of just saying, all right, we're getting on a plane, we are going to Tehran, we want to be right there?
Well, my mom has made 3 trips, and she has been able to see him. Out of the 3 trips, she was able to see him twice.
Okay, so she at least has seen him.
Yeah, but not in the prison itself. I mean, she went to the prison, they brought him to a visiting area, and she was able to see him there.
So what comes next, as far as you know? The sentence was overturned by the Supreme Court in Iran. What now? What do you hear?
Well, we're trying to find out if there is a retrial that's going to be issued, on what basis they're going to determine their next decision. Is the decision going to be something in our favor based on the circumstance we're appealing to have him released based on the fact that he's been there for this long without due process and without access to his attorney on a regular basis, with no contact with his immediate family here in the U.S., and the fact that my father is sick and we don't know how long with his treatment things are going to last. And so we really just want to keep pushing that and raising awareness and using the media as a tool to help us to get that message across, because as a family, as a civilian family, trying to contact people within their system directly, it's not working.
Sarah, how can concerned people who are hearing your story and hearing you talk now, how can they help your effort to get your brother Amir freed from Iran?
There's a lot of ways people can get involved, and we do have a website. It's freeamir.org, and it could be anything from helping raise awareness on social media, getting his story out. A lot of people are not aware of the situation, and so helping people that are active in human rights efforts and getting them aware of the situation, writing to their congressmen, things like that. So a lot of those things can be seen on how to get help and how to show support on the website.
Sarah, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Sarah Hekmati's brother, Amir, was imprisoned while visiting family in Iran. He has been there ever since August 2011. And coming up starting this Saturday is an art show opening up in Detroit at the 555 Gallery and Studios called Jailed Humanity, in support of an American's quest for freedom from an Iranian prison. We'll have all the information on the art show and on freeamir.org on our website at michiganradio.org. It's Thursday, and that means it's time for our weekly salute to a local hero. For this salute, the hero is local and international. This week, retired teacher Glenn Dickerson of Ann Arbor received the French Legion of Honor. This is the very highest honor the French government can bestow. Glenn was honored for his role in liberating France in World War II. Glenn Dickerson joins us in the studio. Glenn, congratulations on becoming one of 91 Michigan World War II vets to receive the Legion of Honor Medal.
I feel like so many others deserved it much more than I did, so I feel that I just, with that medal, I simply represent their feats and their deeds. There are so many of them who didn't make it back, who, if they had, would have been much more qualified for this medal than I was. You see, one of the requirements of the medal is that you had to be alive. It's not given posthumously.
Tell us about your foxhole buddy, Marvin. You say Marvin saved your life?
Marvin and I landed on Omaha Beach D-plus 6. We're a replacement, replacement package. But I didn't really get to know Marvin until about 6 days after that, when the engineers were plugged into the front line until the infantry could be brought back to strength with other replacements. And we were dug into the base of a hedgerow, getting dark. Marvin's hole was 5-10 feet away from mine. And he suggested that I move in with him and we share two blankets. Getting cold. It worked fine. So I abandoned my hole and moved in with Marvin. At sometime in the late evening, another replacement came in and they told him, you know, bed down wherever you can. So he found the hole I had left to move in with Marvin, and he bedded down there. And the next morning, just before it got light, Germans threw in a barrage of 88 shells, and we were all right. We were shaken and stunned, but this poor guy who occupied my hole was killed. So just by chance, Marvin asked me to join him and share blankets. So I always say that that gesture saved my life. Had to. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. The whole war from when I landed in France until the medal ceremony the other day was just a unbelievable chain of events formed by a whole bunch of little links. Any one of them that hadn't occurred, I wouldn't be here.
Let me ask you this. What would you like the young people of today to understand about your war, about World
about
War II?
About our time?
Yes.
I want them to understand that at that time, the entire country was involved. Today, in these latest battles and wars, the entire country, very few are personally involved, just those who are selected to go. But World War II, the whole country was involved. They sold war bonds. They saved grease drippings in a little can and took that to the butcher shop, and that was used to make explosives. They saved scrap metal and they
grew gardens.
I'm trying to say is the entire country was totally and individually involved in the war. And I don't think many people are. The war is just another sidebar in the newspaper or the radio or TV.
You know, when I went on the honor flights, Glenn, I saw young people coming up and shaking veterans' hands and saying thank you and a sense of gratitude. How does it make you feel when someone thanks you for your service?
Kind of humble. I don't deserve it. But I sure understand what they're doing. We did our part, but when they shake my hand, I think, could you wait till I can gather all the guys who didn't come back and those who did? I'll bring them around and we'll shake all our hands. But when that kind of recognition happens, I just think, okay, I'm representing all of them. You're shaking my hand, but you're shaking everybody's hand who didn't come back, and those of us who did and had a career and marriage and children, and they didn't. And that bothers me a lot. And the difference between those who did and like me who did is seconds, inches, luck.
we congratulate you on this beautiful award from the French government, the French Legion of Honor. And thank you for your service.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
And if you know someone that you think is a hero, we want to hear about them. Email us at stateside@michiganradio.org. Find us on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty or tweet us at Stateside Radio. Look forward to hearing from you. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Skahn. Our contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again at 3 o'clock on Monday.